How do you process all the telemetry data from everybody playing Call of Duty right now? We talked to Yaroslav Tkachenko about just that on today's episode of Streaming Audio, a podcast about Kafka, Confluent, and the cloud. Hello and welcome back to another episode of Streaming Audio. I am, as ever, your host, Tim Berglund. I'm joined in the studio today by Yaroslav Tkachenko. Yaroslav, welcome to the show.
Thanks for inviting me.
You got it. Now, you work at Activision, and there's a lot to do at a game company. Always a lot to talk about. Many, many diverse roles. But this being a podcast about Kafka, Confluent, and the cloud, I'm guessing that you are not a game developer proper, but have something to do with a data pipeline. Why don't you tell us about what you do there?
For sure. So I'm a software architect in the Activision data department, which is an interesting mix, right? Because we have quite a few different data teams, and I'm happy to work, you know, with all the teams in the organization, but I mostly focused on the data pipeline development specifically. And it's all kinds of game telemetry from various game clients, various backend services. We collect, we process, we store all the data from all those various games, primarily Call of Duty. And we have various data access tools for internal customers to access the data. And my role is this interesting mix of being, you know, hands-on, as well as driving some of the technical development and guiding the team in all things real-time.
Awesome. And I think best kind of software architect, right, when you're hands-on, when you're still writing code. If you're really guiding a team or an organization as an architect and not occasionally building things, you can get a little unmoored from reality. And that's usually where architecture decisions become bad ones. So always good to see. So give us an idea what this looks like. And I sense we're going to have this discussion kind of in historical terms, but probably everybody listening, whether they've played Call of Duty or not, understands what the experience of playing Call of Duty is like. It's a first-person shooter set in, you know, in various combat theaters across various time periods, you know, in its flavors. But what does the back end look like? I mean, what's going on there?
So modern online games actually are really, really complex beasts, right? It's just this really massive distributed system. And there are so many layers. You know, you have the actual piece of code that's running on the console, as well as, you know, all the online components, all the multiplayer components, where we have a lot of backend services for things like matchmaking, right? So whenever you want to play a match, you need to find someone else who will also wants to play a match at the same time, right? So all things around matchmaking, microtransactions, telemetry, statistics, leaderboards, like all those things. In Activision, we have a separate studio who handles all the online game development. And we have different game studios, you know, usually each year that work on the new version of Call of Duty. They all work with that studio on the new Call of Duty development. And so you have this layer of things like the game client, backend services, some really interesting mix in between, which I am not supposed to talk about today. But actually gathering data from all those things is a very tricky concept, you know, just because all the systems are so complex and they need to, you know, especially in the console environment, you have very, very strict, you know, memory requirements and CPU requirements. So it's very important for your telemetry code to not interfere with the game, you know, the actual game, but you also want to collect the data as accurate as possible. So it's this very interesting mix of things.
Sure. So I guess you have like a frame rate contract in the console, right? You have a certain amount of time to get all of your computation done.
Exactly. And just because of that, we actually spend a lot of time in Activision building some of the in-house binary protocols. So binary protocols optimized for the game. So for example, in some of the versions, you know, we had fixed arrays. So the game could not produce dynamic arrays just because fixed arrays are simpler and you know, cheaper to manage. So those are really tricky requirements to deal with.
Got it. And so the communication between the console and your backend is that custom binary protocol, and then you've got some proxy that takes that and, I assume, produces to a Kafka topic from there.
Exactly. So we have a REST proxy that we build in-house that writes data to Kafka, well, to set of Kafka clusters, because we have quite a few things in between. And we collect data from our data centers as well. So we currently use that REST proxy for, you know, all kinds of public endpoints, for example, game consoles. Right now, we're still collecting the game directly from backend services to Kafka, but we're also thinking about, you know, introducing that, you know, REST layer in between, even in our own data center, just because it can simplify a lot of things.
Cool. What is the? I guess I want to start at the console, and this is all console games, right? I want to start at the console, and you mentioned a little bit about that runtime environment, just that there's a hard real-time requirement. You know, you have a frame rate that you need to meet, and, you know, in the game engine, if you've ever read anything about this kind of thing, there are things that game engines can do to, you know, decide objects not to render and detail not to include and things like that to make that, you know, because you don't get to delay the shipment of the frame. It's going, and, you know, you have a certain amount of time. So you've got this really constrained runtime environment. You said you do some unusual things to optimize execution time footprint. How many different kinds of consoles and different games? Are you mostly Call of Duty? And what's the spectrum of consoles that you have to support in that front end?
Sure. So actually, I've just recently checked. The oldest game that we still support in our pipeline is 9 years old. Wow. So you can make some math, and yeah, it's very tricky. So we support the current generation as well as the previous generation of consoles, plus PCs, currently mostly on Battle.net, but before it was Steam, as well as for Call of Duty Mobile. Right now we have, you know, iPhones and Androids. So that's the list. And in terms of games, you know, Call of Duty obviously is our main focus, but we also, you know, shipped smaller titles like Crash Team Racing was a really successful launch this year, and you know, so some older games like Skylanders too, still running, still ingesting data and using it.
Nice. And so you've got this REST proxy, and that produces to Kafka topics. Take us from there. I mean, we have talked a little bit about there being event-driven microservices on the back end, not on air, but, you know, you and I have worked out some things. Like, there are event-driven microservices back there. This sounds like a giant streaming ETL problem, but boy, just walk me through what happens when telemetry lands in a topic. What do you do with it, and how do you get it there?
Yeah, so actually, our end goal, just to make things simpler, right? So from one side, we have all this data coming through. On the other side, our end customers, you know, we do have some customers that are really comfortable consuming data directly from Kafka, and, you know, they're happy to deal with Kafka consumers and, you know, manage that thing themselves. But we also have quite a few customers and quite a few use cases that just really want, you know, a simple tabular access using something like Presto, Spark, Hive, you know, very, very classic big data tools, as well as some of the NoSQL access, right? So we have some of the API-driven endpoints. So we have this set of interfaces we need to support, which is tabular, streaming, Kafka, and the kind of more classic REST API database-driven approach, right? And so we need to first process all this data that we have, and then we need to route it properly to all those different sinks. And we also need to manage schema evolution, because schema evolution is very tricky in our case. And so right from that REST proxy, we start thinking about what is the, you know, optimal set of topics. Like, how do you even name a topic, really, and why, right? Because you need to understand how to scale that topic, how many partitions you need, how to, you know, how to route the data after that. And so we have a service, internal service called Refinery, that handles, you know, like the initial data aggregation and routing. We try to capture as much information as we can in the initial set of topics, right? So where the data lands. But then that service, refiner service, the very initial kind of part of the ingestion, we then we kind of merge and split some of the topics based on some of the logical conventions we have. For example, in the most recent titles and in the newer pipeline that we have, you know, we try to really end up with a single Kafka topic for the whole game, right? Which might sound a bit crazy, but at the same time, we need to process the whole thing. So it kind of makes sense for us. And then if end customers need a specific subset of the data, we have a service to split that topic even more based on the conditions they have, right? So the initial step is to route the data properly, ingest it properly. Then we transform it into the different formats. And we internally try to use Avro as much as we can. And we obviously, as I said, we have various custom protocols, but we also support things like protocol buffers, JSON, some other proprietary formats. And we have a schema registry for all those things, right? So our data producers, they upload schemas to the schema registry we provide. And then we use those schemas. We deserialize all that into Avro on Kafka. From there, we run a series of transformation steps. And then we expose the data to all those different interfaces.
The tabular and the API and the streaming.
Exactly.
And I totally want to dig into that in a minute, because there's some very timely topics in there that we've been talking about a lot recently. And recently, I always like to make clear, we're recording this in the middle of December 2019. So it'll probably ship early in 2020, but around the end of the year, 2019 is kind of when we're thinking right now. Now, you talked about schema evolution and schema registry, and I didn't quite catch, is that Confluent schema registry? Did you build one of your own? How do you handle all that?
So we actually built a schema registry a while ago, many years ago, and there was no Confluent schema registry available, I would say, at the time.
That's the best reason not to use the Confluent schema registry.
Yes. I would say now, you know, why not? Why not use it? Except, you know, over all those years, you know, we built support for, you know, some of the internal formats, some of the extra validation. So it's just, it feels a bit more mature just for our use cases, obviously, right? But it's all, you know, it's all can be done Confluent schema registry.
Cool. Too. Any special, there's a few things here. So I want to ask you about topic creation in a minute, but any special lessons learned about schema evolution? Like what has worked well, what has not? I wouldn't actually have guessed that would be a daunting problem since game software doesn't change all that much. But I guess the goal is to get all of this into one topic. So no, I take that back. That's a terribly daunting problem. You have 9 years of schema in there. So yeah, that's awful. Oh my goodness, Yaroslav. How's that? What have you learned there?
And so the really, really big problem here is we're not only ingesting the production data, right? So the data that's produced by the live game, we also provide a service for all the Activision developers to send development data to us. So they end up with the, you know, streaming access or tabular access for the development data over the course of a year, for example, or a couple of years when they develop the game. And obviously, when you develop something, you iterate quickly, you end up just creating new schemas almost every day, right? So the really important lesson that we learned is you just absolutely have to automate it, right? So you need to come up with a set of standards, you need to come up with a set of tools, set of services that just handle it for you, right? And obviously, then the question is how do you do that properly? But something you need to just realize immediately, you know, it's not going to be able to just resolve itself, or you can't really leave any kind of room where you need to do something manual, right? So it's all should be automated, and you should provide a very strict guidelines. So, for example, union types are very tricky to handle in a tabular way, right? So support union types except like really, really simple ones.
Okay. I'll come back to union types. It sounded like you described a topic with fairly radical use of unions, but you don't support unions in the events that get produced
the table
from the console, yeah. They can't contain unions.
We fine with simple ones, but we've seen use cases where people just try to put all kinds of stuff in this in this, you know,
sure, I have
in a single union, and it's
I
just,
have 15 types explodes. And I don't really want to think about typing, and so let me make a union out of all of them. Okay. Yeah. Now, let me get to the union thing, because it if you've got you eventually want to get all of this into one topic, that's going to be lots and lots of types, right? I mean, isn't that effectively, don't you model that as a union?
So the topic itself, you know, we don't really care that much about how many different types of messages we have in the topic, because each single record in our topic has a schema, right? So any single message can have absolutely different schema as long as it has a schema ID and the schema is available in the registry. Right, so we really use topic as just a way to transport things, but in the end, you know, each message can have absolutely different schema if they really want to.
Got it. And I guess to set us up for the question I'm about to ask next, is there a language that most of your services are written in, your consuming services?
So it's mostly Java, Python, okay. I would say.
Gotcha.
We do support. We have some C# consumers as well. But it's mostly Java.
So as you're consuming from that topic with all of the types in it, you either reflectively or dynamically create the types that you need to instantiate objects of, I guess is how that would work. You have some wrapper around the consumer that does that for your schema registry.
Exactly. And we're trying to push everyone right now internally to just use Avro, right? Because before we didn't provide a real-time streaming access to the data. And, you know, each team that wanted to consume this real-time telemetry, they actually had to, you know, ingest, parse, and you know, run some lightweight transformations on the data themselves because, well, we just didn't provide that real-time stream. Now with the stream, we, you know, no matter what kind of format we ingest, can be protobuf, can be JSON, can be proprietary formats, we try to always expose data as Avro. So all the end consumers, they only need to deal with Avro, and they all need, you know, they all know how to get schemas from the schema registry. So it's a bit simpler.
Yeah. Okay. Good. And all right. So we've got the goal. There's various topics that things come into, and you have this goal of getting it into one kind of one topic to rule all telemetry. When you do create topics, though, you mentioned a little bit of a governance procedure around that. And this is a question I hear users of Kafka at scale ask sometimes, you know, organizations like you. So if you would, I have two questions. One, about how many developers might write code that functions as a Kafka producer or consumer, regardless of the level of the API, you know, streams or whatever, you know, anybody who's concerned with topics, right? How many developers are doing that? And describe your process for creating a new topic.
Sure. So historically, we actually try to go full auto topic create, right? So we would let our data producers to create topics according to certain convention, right? So if there is a new, completely new backend service in Activision, or maybe there is a new game ID, right? So we kind of partition things initially that way. They should be able to just start sending data to Kafka without any kind of extra permissions or any kind of coordination. They want to send us data, we should be able to process the data. And this is very, very core principle we've been trying to follow. No matter what data producer throws at you, try to ingest it and process it, right? So we've been very, very flexible in terms of how many topics, what kind of topics people want to create, and we just allowed them to send the data. But after that step, internally, we look at all those different things, all those different conventions, and now we're trying to, you know, to introduce more standards and to introduce more, you know, like fat topics comparing to the previous set of slim topics, because actually the number of topics and number of partitions you need to manage, you know, start to matter a lot when you reach certain scale. So we're trying to now come in this problem where we have just a few small a few number of really fat topics to manage. In comparison to a very large number of topics before, where each topic can produce just, you know, a very small volume of data. So it's kind of, you know, trying to inverse that right now.
Right. And how many, I don't know if you're able to disclose, how many people would be thinking about this, would be potential sources of new topics?
Oh, so we try to abstract all this from the, you know, the actual data producers. So I would say we have, 5-7 teams working on the different backend services. Okay. And then a couple studios usually actively developing the game. But again, they just usually interface with the REST API or some of the SDKs we provide. So they shouldn't really care about, you know, what kind of topics they create.
Right. They are, in that case, consumers of other interfaces and not consumers of Kafka directly.
Exactly.
Yeah. I ask exactly. Because there's I think, a sliding scale of governance. You know, once you get to, say, 1,000 people using your Kafka clusters, mm-hmm. and, you know, somebody out there wants to create a topic, you just don't have, you know, as the person responsible for the service or administrating the cluster or whatever the right word is, depending on how you set things up organizationally, you don't really have a lot of common interests with random person from that 1,000 count pool of developers, right? You work for the same company, but you're as good as not, you know, so there tends to be a lot of governance at that scale. But
at the same time, you know, in the last 2 years, I've been hearing self-serve everywhere. And I love the model of self-serve UIs, where you can expose some kind of interface to your end customers. And maybe you can also run some kind of capacity planning or some cost numbers right there.
Yeah.
So when people decide, I need this, you know, huge topic with this, you know, with this number of partitions, with this messages per second, they can see immediately how much it's actually, you know, going to be costing for them, and if we have enough capacity at all, right?
Right. And, you know, I want to hear the word self-serve more. I really do. Everybody, do more self-serve if you can. But it seems like at scale, those bolts always get tightened down a little bit more, but you're at still a pretty workable scale in terms of the number of human beings who might actually want to do this. So it sounds like you've got something that's still relatively free and rewards experimentation and rewards innovation. And you've got a small enough group of people that, you know, there's a sense of common interest and community around this thing that tends to keep those decisions being good decisions.
True, because I notice, you know, some companies, they now offer Kafka as a service, right? So they just provide Kafka as a piece of tech that people can use in different scenarios as different, you know, you can build different solutions on top of Kafka. And we try to provide a fixed number of solutions, a fixed number of use cases for Kafka, but we allow people to send us different kinds of data, right? So we really don't try to position ourselves as Kafka as a service team. We are a data pipeline, a data platform. So we try to provide different level of interfaces, right? REST proxies and SDKs.
Right. That is, Yaroslav, that is absolutely the right framing. You're not Kafka as a service. I mean, Confluent Cloud is Kafka as a service. You are a data layer for online games at Activision.
That's right.
And speaking of which, I don't think I asked this. Do you guys run on-prem?
Oh, so I'm not sure how much I can
totally.
Describe.
Yeah, that's fair point. I just want to know everything.
But
so just give me all the details. private keys, you know, whatever.
I definitely can say a few words. The game itself, all the backend services, obviously, you know, we have a few data centers, but we also run a few things in cloud. All the data stuff, though, like all these data pipelines, we run on AWS. They've been really good partners to us.
Excellent. So,
it's all Amazon's cloud.
Cool.
Yeah.
Okay. These other things, it's kind of funny. Like you said, I don't know, 3 minutes of stuff at the beginning, and I am still unpacking the footnotes in that 3-minute statement. You mentioned three kinds of access to the data. Tabular, API, and streaming. and you said some other kind of compelling things in there. So could you possibly give examples of data? And again, I will always ask questions very likely beyond what you can disclose. So anytime I do that, just don't, obviously just tell me that you can't, but to make those clear to the listener, I have a vague sense of what you might do with those three things. But if you can give examples of tabular data, API data, and streaming data, I want to dig into those because there are some interesting emerging architectural ideas lurking in there that I want to see if we can draw out.
For sure. So in terms of streaming data, I have my favorite example that I always give to people. A couple years ago, we launched Call of Duty World War II, and we also launched Alexa app for Call of Duty. And so we actually have a team in Activision that built this really interesting, you know, machine learning system where they would, in real time, ingest the data, you know, that we already processed. And then they would build certain models. And if you have Alexa, after you finish playing the game, you could ask Alexa, hey, how did I do? And Alexa would tell you, well, you know, next time use this weapon and use this loadout and, you know, suggest a few other things. And also say, by the way, but you're still better than, you know, most of your friends and this. And this is really cool. Like, this is really a cool real-time use case.
Yeah. Right?
And
but yeah, that's that Alexa skill is making an API. There's a synchronous API call behind that skill, right?
So what they really wanted to achieve, they wanted to achieve this real-time machine learning, right? So they wanted to ingest data and also build certain models in the background. And the team also manages some of the, you know, kind of personalization services. So if you, you know, if you reached, I don't know, 20 kills in the game, they want to be able to know that information immediately so they can show it on the, I don't know, a mobile app, web app, as well as use it in that personalization engine. So they kind of trying to decouple calling all the data services versus the, you know, the data models they have themselves. And it makes sense because they want to optimize things a certain way.
So let me dig into that a little bit more. You still, and actually, let me tell you about the distinction that I'm thinking about. So so you don't have to guess, but there are some kinds of consumers of streaming data that want events pushed to them, right? Like I'm doing some computing in aggregate, I'm running some machine learning model, and I want each new event pushed into me, and I will do my computation, and my state will change according to that computation, and we'll go from there. Then there are other consumers of streaming data that actually want to go and ask, and it might be like the state of that model or the table that results from an aggregation. Somebody might want to, as it were, synchronously say, hey, you know, for player owned you 372, just made that up. Maybe that actually is a name. Apologies if it is. You know, what's the current score? What's the current kill count? You know, that would be an aggregation, a windowed aggregation over some like session window kind of thing. So there's queries where you go and ask synchronously, and then there's stream processors that need messages asynchronously pushed into them. And you listed tabular API and streaming. And I just want to try and figure out like, okay, so streaming would be these ML models, right? That would be a streaming consumer.
Yeah, exactly. And any kind of tooling that really needs the, you know, the access for data in real time. For example, some of the game studios, they would kind of reconsume the data again that they sent to us. And they want this really low latency dashboards in the studio so they can, you know, make changes. And this is, you know, a really good use case for something like metrics, right? So they would send a bunch of metrics from the consoles, things like error rates, things like, you know, crash dumps. And they want to see the data immediately as soon as possible in, you know, all kinds of dashboards and visualization.
And I'm envisioning some sort of network control center or network operations center, sort of big dark room with lots of screens. Okay.
Exactly. Yeah.
That word picture is amazing, by the way. That sounds like a very fun place to spend time. I'm sure highly secure, but it would be cool to be on the inside. You mentioned some tabular or NoSQL things. Can you talk about what goes on there? Because that's also sort of interesting to take streaming data and put it in a big database and then and then have some process that queries it. So what's the use case there?
Yeah, so Tabular is actually our, you know, one of the core products that we provide. So we spend a lot of time on making sure the thing is optimized. And the architecture is very simple, right? So we have Apache Hive Metastore with a bunch of tables on S3. So our goal is to archive the data on S3 in the right format and also modify the schema in Hive to reflect, you know, new fields, new tables, all the, you know, standard schema evolution tricks. And the interesting thing is, this year we actually switched to the new version of the pipeline where we started using Kafka Connect for the S3 integration. And we invested a lot in trying to make that, you know, really seamless experience for all the developers and for the end users. And we also invested a lot of time in automation on the, you know, on the schema evolution side, on the Hive schema side. So we have services that will automatically understand, you know, if due to a schema update, you need to append a few new columns to the table in Hive. So they just, you know, deal with the schema evolution again in this very automated way. The same thing goes about tables, new events, new partitions, right? So we're trying to use Connect with S3 to partition and transform and, you know, upload the data to S3. And we also have a set of services for the Hive schema evolution.
Awesome. So for some of those tabular views, you end up with data in S3 and then services in front of that allow you to query.
Yeah, we use Presto, Spark. And again, this use case is very important because all the reporting is, you know, based on that. So if Activision leadership wants to know how much money we made last week, this is where, you know, ultimately you would go looking.
Oh, nice. Okay. So that's quite timely. Tell us, and you've been there 2.5 years. So what is the before and after? And this is a typical concern of the software architect. You've kind of hinted at some of this, but if you could just step back and say, you know, this is what existed some number of years ago, and this is what exists now, and this is the future state you're moving toward. What's the kind of timeline of all this?
For sure. So the pipeline itself is very old. You know, we survived quite a few iterations, and the previous iteration we still run quite a few services. It was a very classic ETL, you know, Hadoop stack ETL, where we have data on S3 and we use MapReduce and Hive and Spark and all those classic big data tools to actually run ETL. But for that pipeline, the interesting part was the ingestion of data, because the data originally landed in Kafka. That Kafka was managed by a different team. And then when this team tried to, you know, mirror the data and process it and run some transformations, the team actually faced quite a few limitations due to the way they run Kafka. So I cannot really tell too much about how exactly it was done, but the summary was you just could not add more brokers or partitions after a certain, you know, certain level you reached due to some licensing and some other interesting restrictions. And so the team got very creative, and, you know, you have Kafka, you still need to scale. So they ended up using SQS. This is the Amazon's queue service, right? So we still ended up using Kafka as a message bus to pass, you know, certain metadata messages around. But for the actual kind of, you know, work distribution, we would end up using SQS. And so it was a very tricky mix of Kafka and SQS, and then you're going into this Hadoop world, right? So the pipeline was quite complex. And the tricky part, again, was handling the scale, because for production scale, you know, this makes sense, and people are happy to wait for, you know, 4 to 6 to even 24 hours while all this MapReduce and Hive tasks are running. But you also have this development data use case, and people really want to see development data, you know, within seconds or at least minutes. And so we had to build like a smaller version of that ETL just for development data scale. But that meant a different set of tables, different set of schemas. So people got really unhappy with the way, you know, this distinction happened, right? So when you start developing your game, you would end up querying and accessing one set of tables. When you launch the new game, you would have to switch to a new set of tables. And that was, again, really frustrating. Right.
And error prone, sounds like, for transitioning from deployment or from development to deployment.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, this year we really invested in a lot of infrastructure, and we just decided, you know, we want to go 100% Kafka, using Kafka Streams, Kafka Connect, using as much Kafka as we can. And yeah, so right now we don't have that layer of classic Hadoop ETL anymore, just because we ingest and we transform all the data using Kafka Streams. And we use Kafka Connect for certain integrations like S3, like Cassandra, like Elasticsearch, right? So all that is handled in Connect, and we are trying to use streams and streaming ETL as much as we can. And this actually dramatically reduced latency. Instead of waiting for 4 to 6 hours as an end customer, now you wait maybe up to 5-10 minutes in a production scale, which was really nice change. And apparently the pipeline is also way cheaper, but that's mostly due to the laziness of us, because we didn't probably spend enough time trying to optimize the Hadoop ecosystem, right? But it's really, really, big difference in the cost as well.
Cool. And on that last point about your alleged sloth, fair enough. We don't always optimize everything. And I think it's usually good judgment not to optimize too soon, but I mean, it is a win. It's still a win. I mean, you were, as you say, too lazy to optimize Hadoop. I don't know if you've suddenly discovered this zest for optimization and you've squeezed every cycle out of your Kafka cluster. If you could take basically the same operational approach and get a cheaper footprint, you know, cheaper computational and storage footprint, then that's a win, right? That's a good thing.
Exactly. Yeah.
Streams. Talk to me about Streams. That's fantastic. What do you do with Streams?
So we have this classic.
Well, I guess you said you do everything with Streams, so you've already answered that question. But what I mean is, tell me about some transformations and just your general approach.
Sure. As a data platform team, we're really trying to focus on the transformation side of things. We are not running a lot of streaming analytics or machine learning. Like, we have different teams. But ourselves, we invest in Kafka Stream services that ingest data, parse it. You know, they can access the schema registry. We try to transform everything into Avro, and then we run some transformations. For example, for the tabular representation, you know, when you have this deeply nested data, like, you can have up to seven levels of various objects and arrays in certain payloads. Again, it's really tricky to display that data in tabular way. So we have services that can flatten it, that can create certain child tables with the certain columns that you can use to join things. And so we try to use a single service as a big transformation step, and then just have different stages of the pipeline represented as Kafka topics. So if if we have a customer who's interested in a certain intermediate stage, and we certainly have those use cases, they can just consume those topics, right? But if they care about the end result, they can either consume the final, tabular topic or the actual set of tables.
Awesome. All right. Other things that come up in your world that are of interest to, I mean, there's a few things that seem like they would happen in game telemetry that people always ask me about, like personal data, PII, things like where does that enter your world, and what sort of processes or frameworks have you put in place to help?
Sure. So we try to always follow certain standards, certain guides that we basically created for ourselves when we handle PII. And we actually have an actual service that can handle the PII kind of cleanup, how we can call it, or you know, extracting the relevant PAI and then anonymizing data for all the downstream customers. So we trying to make sure we always capture all the relevant PAI in case we need it. And this you know, set of tables is, you know, audited, it's locked down, and the data is always encrypted and, you know, all the proper words I'm going to say. But for the end users, you know, usually as a, you know, as an analyst or data scientist, you don't care about PA that much. And so we're trying to, you know, always anonymize data. And again, it's just due to certain standards we established, like if you really need to send a PAI to the, you know, the data lake, you need to also provide this, you know, set of fields. For example, you know, with the latest Call of Duty, we now have crossplay, where people from PlayStation can play with people on Xbox, wow, right? And if you have, let's say, a username, you really need to understand if it's a username on PlayStation or Xbox, because, you know, the same username can exist in both platforms. And, you know, by requesting a really, you know, simple rules, but nevertheless rules from our data producers, we can gather all the metadata that's necessary for us to anonymize the data properly and then also have a way to access it if needed.
Now, in the transition from the old Hadoop ETL world to the current streaming world, across a relatively large number of years of game versions and console versions and so forth, my guess is that you had certain internal customers for data that you computed in the old way that you migrated to the new way, right? It wasn't just all standing up new greenfield data sources. You had to migrate things.
Definitely.
How did you go about that? I guess this is kind of a special form of the how do I refactor the monolith to services question. It's kind of like that. But how did you do that? You know, did you keep the external contract and the customer knew nothing? Did you change that API? Walk me through one of those migrations.
Mm-hmm. So the biggest use case to discuss here really is tabular access, because, you know, if it's streaming access, then you just end up with a different set of schemas,
right?
Suddenly. And if you have that schema integration working, then it will just handle it. So this is not very, very hard to manage. The same about API, right? If your RESTful API provides a very generic message representation, for example, it returns a certain envelope, and then inside that envelope you have, you know, any kind of arbitrary set of bytes, and then again the schema maybe, or it's sort of parsed bytes in JSON or some other format. Like, this is all very manageable, I would say. The tabular access, though, is tricky, because people run a lot of ETL on top of that. People use a lot of dashboards on top of that, and people in general, we're used to the idea of, you know, if I need to calculate the number of daily active users, I just need to run this piece of SQL and that's it, right? So it's very easy. With tabular access, you suddenly have way more users because it's just simple SQL, and people suddenly start to, you know, to be attached to a few very important tables. So any kind of attempt to change that, you know, is very tricky, because people just asking, why would you need to change that? I'm so happy with what I have. So the strategy is very simple. In this case, we provided a set of, you know, new schemas in Hive Metastore with the new tables, and we said, you know what, you can still keep using, you know, the old way for now. We allow you that, but if you switch to the new set of tables, the rate of updates on the data is, you know, 10 minutes versus 6 hours.
There you go.
And also we handle deduplication better due to all those extra things. And also we handle small files problem better for the development data. And they like, let me try that. And, you know, we've got a few early customers that were really surprised by the performance, by latency, and yeah, it's not a quick exercise. Definitely, it's a long process. But if you give your customers something that's, you know, significantly better, and you push them a little bit to the right direction, they will figure it out.
Yes, I can't underscore that enough. Everyone listening, That's how you do a migration. You produce a better service and then let your customers volunteer to upgrade to that service because they're getting value that they couldn't get in the old version. You don't hector them. You don't use a club. You give them something that works better. And how long did it take on average, if you can recall a few transitions?
It's still happening.
As usual. So, you know,
yeah,
people have their own struggles, and maybe the old version's good enough for now, but that still strikes me as a brilliant way to do it.
Thanks.
My guest today has been Yaroslav Tkachenko. Yaroslav, thanks for being a part of Streaming Audio.
Thank you.
And there you have it. Hey, it's Kafka Summit time again, and you get another discount code for listening all the way to the end. Kafka Summit London is coming up on April 27th and 28th of 2020, and you can get 30% off your registration if you go to kafka-summit.org and use the discount code KSL20AUDIO during checkout. Just enter KSL20AUDIO while registering at kafka-summit.org, and that 30% off is all yours. I would love to see you there. And anyway, I hope this podcast was helpful to you. If you want to discuss the podcast or ask a question, you can reach out to me at TL Berglund on Twitter. That's at TLBERGLUND. Or you can leave a comment on a YouTube video or reach out to us in community Slack. There's a Slack sign-up link in the show notes if you want to join that group. And while you're at it, please subscribe to our YouTube channel and to this podcast wherever fine podcasts are sold. If you subscribe through iTunes, be sure to leave us a review there. That helps other people discover the podcast, which we think is a good thing. Thanks for your support, and we'll see you next time.